Hello and welcome to The World in 30 Minutes, the podcast on the events, policies and ideas that will shape the world from the European Council on Foreign Relations. My name is Mark Leonard. I'm director of ECFR. And this week's podcast will be about the geoeconomics of the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, that is. Amid all the talk of geopolitical fragmentation and the rise of middle powers, the UAE and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and other small countries in this region stand out for their successful attempts to reinvent themselves as regional linchpins. Despite the rise of protectionism, Russia's invasion of Ukraine and America's rising tensions with China, they've demonstrated remarkable flexibility, or some might even say opportunism, not just doing business with the US, with Europe, but also with China and with Russia, as well as expanding ties with each other and with countries such as Iran, and are reaping considerable economic rewards in the process. How have the UAE, Qatar, Saudi Arabia managed to juggle these competing powers? What lessons do their strategies hold for other middle powers? And what should the EU be doing to pursue its own interests in the region? To discuss these questions and many more, we're joined by an all-star cast. With me today, we have Cinzia Bianco, who is a visiting fellow on the MENA programme with expertise on the Arabian Peninsula and the Gulf.
Kemi is deputy head of ECFR's Paris office and a policy fellow in the MENA programme, focusing on Gulf-China relations and geoeconomics.
And also back to the podcast, we have Agathe Demaret, who is a senior policy fellow here who leads our work on geoeconomics. So welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Mark.
So, Cinzia, why don't we go to you first? We've seen a very difficult economic environment in the world, but a lot of these countries have been through supercharged economic growth, not just with their rise in the profitability of hydrocarbons, but the non-oil sector seems to be even outperforming their overall growth. How are they pulling this off?
Yeah, I mean, the case of Dubai here is particularly interesting. Dubai seemed to have benefited from all of the shocks and geopolitical and geoeconomic shocks, even from, you know, sort of the post-pandemic protectionism, by trying to remain a safe haven for globalization. And so it has attracted, obviously, a lot of Russian capital after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and especially the sanctions regime applied by the West against Russia. It has attracted also a lot of Chinese capital after, for example, in March 2023, Chinese leader Xi Jinping tied up and restricted the freedom of capital movement within Greater China itself. It has attracted a lot of capital and wealth from the region itself. A lot of wealthy businessmen or investors trying to find a sort of a safer place in the region to put their money, escaping Lebanon, obviously, which is facing economic collapse. But many other countries which are in a similar situation ended up bringing that money to Dubai and investing in different sectors, real estate and assets of various type, but also simply keeping and safeguarding liquidity in different forms.
Great. So you mentioned how they're benefiting from all these different shocks, and you were talking specifically about Dubai there. Has Saudi Arabia, have the other countries done exactly the same thing, or are there differences?
So I think Dubai really stands out as a special case. I think the Saudis in general are looking at that success story and are trying to replicate some of it. But Dubai has always been kind of special, also in terms of its disregard for, in a way, you know, rules even, and sort of always a rejection for restrictions. So it does stand out, but it is an example, as it has been for other cases. You know, Qatar, Doha, they've tried to build a Qatari version of Dubai. And the Saudis are also sort of looking at this Emirati trend of being free from restrictions and protectionism and are trying to replicate it as much as possible. And we can see that, for example, in how they're trying to do business with both West and East. They're really, really very adamant that they're not going to cut back relations with China of any kind. And they're trying to also embrace this geoeconomic multipolarity in things like, for example, currency diversification. And they're quite adamant about that as well.
And also joining the BRICS as well, which is part of that kind of picture, I suppose.
Absolutely. The BRICS is emerging as the major platform for this effort by the Emiratis and Saudi Arabia to diversify and embrace this geoeconomic multipolarity. Saudi Arabia has claimed it is still not 100% officially in the BRICS Plus, but we've seen multiple indications that this is just a matter of time or a matter of sort of defining the fine prints. But that's a very clear direction that they're taking, and for the same reason.
So let's look at how they kind of handle these relations. Maybe we can start with you, Kemi, because you've been looking at the China angle a lot. Do you want to talk a bit about the China angle, how UAE and Saudi are navigating the US-China competition?
Sure. I think that the relationship with China is very interesting to watch because it has evolved a lot from being a relationship that was merely based on energy ties. China has become, and you know, over the past 10 years, the biggest energy client of this region. And it has developed, especially for countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, to new sectors, including on new technologies, biotech, AI. And on these kind of key strategic sectors, we see growing tensions and frictions between how these countries navigate between the US and China. They are facing a growing dilemma here because the US remains their top security partner, by far, but also Western countries continue to be key economic players, especially in those kind of strategic sectors like new technologies, AI, where they are still perceived as key partners of the Gulf states for the diversification strategies. But on the other hand, China is also the biggest energy client and a huge market and a key partner that is emerging as well, that is going to be very important for these countries' diversification strategies. And so the Gulf states cannot really afford to choose between one country and the other. And they have until now resisted as much as possible the US pressures to pick sides. And they have been trying as much as possible to develop parallel ties both with China and with the West. But what we see is in some sensitive sectors, especially AI and new technologies, they are coming to a point where there are sometimes actually forced by the US to pick sides. And we have some recent cases, for example, of the Emirati leading AI company, G42, that was constrained by its US partners to cut ties with Chinese companies and Chinese hardware if they wanted to be able to continue working with key US tech companies. So what's interesting here is to see that they try to reject pressures from the US to pick sides for as long as possible. But until now, when they are forced to take a side, they continue to go for Western companies because they consider that they're more, maybe more innovative, considered as a more, it's more prestigious to work with these big Western companies, especially in the sector of technologies and AI. So, but that's something that is emerging and increasing a lot recently.
So China's one angle. The other big angle is Russia. We got lots of sanctions against Russia, including export controls in all sorts of different areas. I guess you all are expert on sanctions and de-risking and have been looking at this very, very closely. Every time people look at ways of circumventing sanctions, the sorts of countries we've been talking about come up very prominently. Their exports of technology to Russia seem to have grown somewhat dramatically since the invasion of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. How does that fit into their strategy?
I think it fits into the strategy of these countries very well, of playing a game of being active with every economy, you know, I think it works very well. And I, as you've mentioned, when we talk about sanctions evasion, the list of usual suspects is Serbia, the UAE, China, some Central Asian countries. I think the one thing to remember here is it's not really sanctions evasion because these countries have not signed up for sanctions. They do not implement sanctions. So they're very free to do business with Russia. And I think that this point is sometimes lost in the conversation. Firms in these countries are free to do business with Russia. And what this highlights to me is the lack of leverage from Western countries to get other countries on board with sanctions efforts against Russia.
But isn't it sanctions evasion in the sense that lots of Western companies are prevented from doing from exporting certain technologies to Russia, particularly technology companies? And they get around it by exporting it to UAE, which then miraculously finds that its markets with Russia are growing. So it's a kind of rebadging.
So that's the grey zone thing, because I think that European firms would say that it's very, very hard to track what happens to a microchip when they sell a microchip to the UAE.
Particularly if you don't want to track it.
That's the problem also. Do they want to track it? That's a key question. I think they would say they want to track it, but it's very difficult in practice. Microchips are very small, etc., etc. Intermediaries, very opaque supply chains. Sanctions evasion, actually, as EU officials say, it starts at home. When a European firm sees that its exports to, say, a UAE firm are booming, they need to ask themselves questions. But I think that what this shows is that sanctions implementation is really, really tricky when you get these intermediaries, such as Gulf countries, that do not sign up for sanctions and say, we don't really see a problem with doing business with Russia. And of course, this highlights, fragmentation around the world and different views around the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And that is really something that is difficult, I would say, for Europe and the US to fight against. That's tricky, but I think that...
So basically...
See you disagreeing.
No, I'm not disagreeing at all. I'm just trying to probe a bit more. So, because, you know, this is a problem with all sanctions regimes. One of the things that the US has traditionally been quite aggressive on is going after these third countries and threatening their companies with consequences if they go against American sanctions. How come these sorts of techniques don't seem to be having an effect on countries in the Gulf?
There are two things here. The first thing is that the US is not imposing secondary sanctions against Russia, except on the military sector yet. And what this highlights is the fact that the US is super cautious about getting sanctions on Russia, right? What does it mean, secondary sanctions? These sanctions would force all firms around the world to make a choice between doing business with Russia and doing business with the US. And so far, the US has been super cautious here because Russia is such a large economy, a major exporter of commodities, that you would have massive ripple effects around the world if you were to ban all firms around the world from doing business with Russia. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is that sanctions are typically financial sanctions, and you can track them tracking financial transfers and what banks do. And that's not too hard to do as long as you have control over financial channels such as SWIFT. But for high-tech sanctions, controlling what happens to a microchip, whether you want to do it or you don't really want to do it, you know, if you're engaging in sanctions evasion, that's much harder. These are super tiny, small components. You could easily smuggle them, you know, with a suitcase. And that's therefore making it very, very difficult to track sanctions compliance and evasion. Of course, there are ways to tackle this, but so far they're not being implemented. So then there's the debate about whether this would be a good idea or not. But I think that this shift towards tech sanctions from financial sanctions is a structural trend, and it makes it important to develop new ways to track sanctions compliance and new tools, new frameworks, pretty much.
So one of the things that was mentioned earlier on was this move towards de-dollarization and buying things in other and selling things in other currencies, which obviously related to this question of the financial sanctions. How does that fit into this sort of framework that you were talking about? Because one of the conditions for joining the BRICS is you have to be against unilateral sanctions. That's one of the rules which countries that want to join the BRICS have to sign up to. And that, I suppose, is related to de-dollarization, because one of the ways of evading the unilateral sanctions is using other currencies.
Yes, absolutely. So you have three blocks, I would say, that a number of countries are putting into place when they want to evade sanctions. And the way I would call it is that it's sanctions vaccination. These are preemptive steps. It's not sanctions evasion. It's really about vaccination, preventive steps to make sure that they're not hit by sanctions. So de-dollarization, as you've mentioned, is one. And actually, I was double checking. And in July last year, the UAE and India have signed a currency swap agreement. What this means is that they can do business in their domestic currencies. They don't need to use the dollar anymore. So that's a first step to shield their economies from US sanctions. But it wouldn't be enough if they still use Western financial channels such as SWIFT. So the second step, and China really leads the way here, is to design alternative financial channels. And China has it. It's called SIPS, much smaller than SWIFT at the moment. But China doesn't really care. You know, it's all about having a plan B in case a country or some firms are excluded from SWIFT. And it also gives China offensive ability to cut off entire countries and companies from its market. If China were to say, well, to do business with us and we're a big economy, you need to use our financial channels, and it's called SIPS. So that's the second block. And then the third block, and actually there are all also moves in the Gulf about this, it's digital currencies. So the digital yuan, for instance, which is already used by 300 million Chinese people, and we're seeing some moves for cross-border trade with this digital yuan. There's a project called Mbridge. I know that Xinjia has been following this very closely. At the moment, it's a pilot project for cross-border trade. China, Thailand, having a look at how it works. But there is interest from Gulf countries to sign up for this project. And it's very significant because this is completely shielded from sanctions. So it's all part of this broader picture of sanctions vaccination. And so in the long run, one can really ask, will sanctions continue to be effective in the long run or not? It's not a black and white thing. Sanctions will not cease to be effective from one day to another, but their effectiveness could well wane over time.
So I want to pivot to Europe quite soon and talk about how Europeans should do it. But before we do that, you know, we've been talking a lot about the sort of more the economic side and the different economic channels. But what about the geo side? What are all of these policies designed to achieve politically for these countries? Don't know who wants to have a crack at that.
I mean, I'll go. I think the idea here is to really... these countries are seeing the end of course, they've seen the end of the unipolar model, and they see a potential emergence of a bipolar model or a multipolar model. And I think they strongly lean towards multipolarity, and they see a lot of Western sort of resistance to that, and some sort of even, they would call it revanchism against the advance of the global South. But in a way, they feel they're part of the global South, and within a global South context, they can be leaders. For example, Agathe was mentioning the Enbridge project, which is, yes, still at a pilot phase, but it is quite cutting edge and innovative. And the UAE has been pushing it very, very hard. This is not a Chinese project that the UAE has embraced. The UAE is actively involved in the technology side into making this digital currency cross-border trade thing really happening. And the Saudis, are looking at that with a lot of interest, and they have their own sort of smaller trial project bilaterally with the UAE itself, because they know that they have something to learn from a technological point of view called Abir, and they are sort of exploring and trying to see how deep they can go. So I think the whole point of it is really to try and make sure that to try and work towards preserving and fostering this multipolarity that they see advancing, because they think that in that context, they can be stronger. And it, to a certain extent, that has already been true, because we were talking about a lack of leverage, Western leverage, against countries that are doing transshipment towards Russia. I mean, just for a second, let's look back at October 2022, where the Biden administration had really put all of its pressure on Saudi Arabia to make sure that they wouldn't cut production, oil production. They wouldn't get to an agreement to cut oil production with Russia, pushing back the prices even further. They were already sky high. The Saudis, they just didn't just resist. They actively pushed back, and they decided to cut production even further when they had sort of promised the Americans that they wouldn't. So that all of the, this is just one example, which is, I think, quite clear of a trend whereby, you know, within a multipolar system, they have, they feel they have more space for maneuver. And right now we're looking at another case, because we know that the Saudis are actively opposing measures or discussions to potentially freeze Russian assets and use that those assets to fund military efforts in Ukraine. So we know that the Saudis are resisting that. And the reason is not just because it is convenient for them financially, but because they don't want Russia to be crushed.
So what should Europeans be trying to do in their relations with these different countries? Kemi, you spent a long time living in the region. What do you think? How should Europeans think about this new Gulf in geoeconomic terms?
Yeah, I think we see that there's a lot of very interesting dynamics going on. And I think that it's important that the Europeans really take this seriously, that they understand how these changes are affecting them, impacting their relations with not only the middle powers in the Gulf, but also it's not just impacting their ability to shape what's happening in the Gulf or in the Middle East, but it's also these countries, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, are positioning themselves as influential middle powers that can have an impact on wider global politics. And so having these countries on board is also important and can have an impact on things that go way beyond the Middle East itself, and including in case of an escalation in the Indo-Pacific, given that the Gulf states are major providers of energy to the entire region. Again, we see that it's important to they can be important pivotal players in a conflict that happens outside of the Middle East. And so taking that seriously for the Europeans is very important. At the same time, I think it's important for Europeans to remain cool-headed because there is sometimes a lot of hype and a tendency to inflate a little bit those debates, including the debate about de-dollarization. It's also in the interest of the Gulf countries to inflate and exaggerate, you know, the importance of the relationship with China to increase their bargaining power towards the Europeans. And so I think it's important for the Europeans not to give up too quickly into these narratives of a declining West and declining Europe, because they it's important to keep their bargaining power when they relate to these Gulf countries.
Okay, what do you think, Agathe?
I think there are two words that to me are key here. The first one is transactional. I think that what we're seeing is really middle powers having an increasingly transactional approach. And this is very clear, you know, when we think about the start of our conversation, we heard that these countries are having relationships with China, with Western economy, but also with middle powers. So it's all about seeing these countries asserting themselves, defending their interests, which is quite a steep change. You know, I think a decade or two ago, we would have expected that Saudi Arabia would always side with the US no matter what. So I think this transactional question is really important. And this is something that we at ECFR have worked on when we talk about strategic interdependence for the European Union. How can we Europeans operate in such a world where middle powers are increasingly voicing their concerns and their interests? So first keyword to me, transactional. And the second one is gateways. Because we're seeing Middle Eastern countries in the Gulf positioning themselves as gateways between East and West for trade, for finance, for infrastructure, but also in the diplomatic field, you know, acting in these fields as gateways. And I think that this trend is a structural one that would probably need some reckoning for Europeans and some adjustment, but I don't think that it's going to go away anytime soon. So to me, transactional and gateways are really the two keywords here.
Okay, last word to you, Cinzia.
I think Europeans need to define very clear red lines and stop expecting full alignment on the broad spectrum of, you know, their preference, but just define very clear red lines and even perhaps be a bit more cynical and take advantage of those gray zones where they don't cross head on their strategic interests.
Okay, well, it's been a really fascinating discussion. There's one thing left to do on this podcast, and that's our bookshelf section. Cinzia, what's on your bookshelf at the moment?
All right. I can recommend a movie that should just have been released on international platforms called There's Still Tomorrow. In Italian, C'è ancora domani. It's a contemporary neorealist movie about women's status and women's rights in the post-war period in Italy. It is quite moving, but has that kind of also that kind of bitter irony that makes it quite enjoyable as well.
So, Camille, what's on your bookshelf at the moment?
So, on my bookshelf, I have the book The Power of Currencies and Currencies of Power by Christian Lemierre. But I would say, on a more entertaining note, I would recommend the Netflix show Three Body Problem that is adapted from the science fiction novel of the Chinese writer Liu Cixin. It's interesting, I think, because it's the first Chinese sci-fi book that is receiving such an international echo outside of China. But it's also interesting to watch how this Netflix adaptation is already at the center of a lot of politics in the context of the China-US rivalry. So probably something to follow in the coming month.
So, Agat, what's on your bookshelf at the moment?
On my bookshelf at the moment, I'm actually rereading a really great book called Blind Man's Bluff by Sherry Sontag and Christopher Drew. And it's about American submarine espionage operations in the Cold War. So you read about intelligence operations against Russia, of course, but also turf wars between the US Navy and the CIA for some operations, and how things were designed and how submarine warfare really played a huge role in the Cold War. I found it absolutely fascinating. I read it once and I'm reading it again and I'm learning a lot of new things. So definitely a book that I would recommend.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, please let other people know about it by writing about it on your social media page or ours, but above all, by hopefully giving us a good rating and a positive review on whatever platform you use to download this podcast. We'll put links up to all the publications we mentioned on our website at ecfr.eu. But for now, from Cinzia, Kemi, Agat, and myself, Mark Leonard, it's goodbye. The researcher for this podcast is Anand Sundar, and the editor of this episode is Mireya Farrow-Saratz.